Tonight we propose to consider Sri Aurobindo in relation to the present world situation. Many, if not most of us, are rather grimly aware of the fact that we are passing through a more than usual critical and trying period. To introduce this and to present immediately the seriousness of Sri Aurobindo's own view, I'll read a short portion of an answer in one of his correspondents. I am afraid I can hold out but cold comfort, for the present at least, to those of your correspondents who are lamenting the present state of things. Things are growing worse, and may at any time grow worse, or worse than worst, if that is possible. And anything, however paradoxical, seems possible in the present perturbed world. The best thing for them is to realize that all this was necessary because certain possibilities had to emerge and be got rid of if a new and better world was at all to come into being. It would not have done to postpone them for a later time. It is as in yoga, where things active or latent in the being have to be put into action in the light so that they may be grappled with and thrown out, or to emerge from latency in the depth of the same purificatory purpose. Also, they can remember the adage that night is darkest before dawn, and that the coming of dawn is inevitable. But they must remember, too, that the new world whose coming we envisage is not to be made of the same texture as the old, and different only in pattern, and that it must come by other means, from within and not from without. So the best way is not to be too much preoccupied with the lamentable things that are happening outside, but themselves to grow within so that they may be ready for the new world, whatever the form may take. This confirms the feeling of extreme gravity which many of us have shared with respect to what we now face. In order to present just what the world situation is, let us make a brief survey of factors which we can see operating. First of all, I will ask you to assume certain primary points of view as a starting point, postulates if you please, that are nonetheless principles or truths from certain levels of realization, but which are not definitely known by everyone. The first principle or postulate will be this: that the underlying basis of the evolution, and of all, as a matter of fact, is consciousness in some sense. Second, that the evolutionary process follows this general principle, that at the beginning, at the starting point, we have an involution of spirit into a state of profound trance, if you please. But a state that seems to us like profound in conscience. Then there is an urge imminent in this involved spirit or divinity to emerge. And corresponding to that urge, there is a descent from the fully conscious transcendent spirit or divine above, which reach towards the imminently emerging principle. This happening in critical steps from time to time, with interludes between that are more or less continuous in their development. Evolution then thus proceeds through a series of crises intercalated between intervals of more or less quiet, continuous development. The critical periods, the periods of when some new principle, operating principle, is to emerge, involve the stirring into activity of forces that are adverse to the emerging quality or principle. It would seem that always there are collateral powers, finite in their nature, that somehow have sprouted off of the main stem of the evolutionary course. These powers have an entrenched interest in what we might call the status quo of any particular existence stage in the evolution. When a new impulse for a new emergence comes, these forces oppose it, resist it with all that they have. And they are the first elements to make themselves conspicuous upon the surface. The result is that the enemy, the opponent, the hostile force in any great crisis is the feature that is most obvious. But the underlying operating force, the relatively unseen force, save to those whose spiritual vision is awakened, is an evolutionary drive and a spiritual descent. Briefly, we may say that certain very important stages have been passed in the history through which our being has grown. Life emerged from matter. The desire and desire mind, such as we see in the animal, emerged from life. From this, a higher phase of mind which differentiates man. And then beyond that, the next step, which so far only the very few pioneers in the race have taken, is an emergence of a spiritual being. This that happens in the evolution of the individual is paralleled by a similar development in collective being, which goes over its steps also. Evolution may be viewed as a basic process of which the integral yoga, not all yoga, but integral yoga, is a duplicate, speeding up the process so that steps which normally left to the course of nature would take untold thousands of years may be covered by the individual in the short period of a life or two. But the collective development moves not by this special power of yoga which applies to the individual, but by the forces of nature in her massive sense. The significance of the present situation is this, that we're in the midst of an impingement, a special impingement of spiritual energy from above and of a yearning, driving force from within the nature itself to emerge into some other vaster and different status and dynamic phase. Now, as we look across the world, we can see some of the signs of this special effort. Those of you who can look back 50 years, who are old enough to have been observers as much as 50 years ago, can note certain very impressive facts. You can note this, that if we go back to 1900, take into account the total technological development of man up to that point, put that on one side, and then his technological development since 1900 on the other side, we'll find that the total development of power under man's control from the beginning of history up to 1900 is only a fraction of the power which he has released in the past 50 years. In the fields of communication, the same truth applies. In the development of various gadget instrumentations, the same thing applies. In other words, we're face to face with a period of extremely strong development in forms that change our way of life, putting a pressure upon all of us to change old life habits, old mental habits, old ways of feeling, old moral codes. Now you must remember that our forefathers had a background of habit forms, intellectual, physical, and emotional, that had the benefit of centuries for their establishment. Forms that, because of changes that are taking place now, no longer make them valid. This puts a pressure upon man's nervous system, his mental nature, his soul nature, that in some cases actually breaks the individual. There is increase of insanity under the pressure. It means that we must be able to rise under this pressure to another way of life, another way of evaluation, another way of conscious movement, or else go under. Now, that much we can see from just watching this purely technological side of things. Let us look at another phase. We see old political and social institutions being overturned in a worldwide sense. There is a revolutionary pressure that has been abroad. I'm talking, of course, of the span of 50 years or so, not merely of the last 4 or 5, because in these massive movements of nature, 50 years is a very short time. The Orient is not what the Orient was. She is no longer content to be what she was. She's insisting of coming out into life in a modern sense. The West is no longer what it was in the 19th century. It's also acting under this yeast that's driving it. We can see it in the religious field as well. Old religious forms losing their vitality. New religious forms coming in. But the features that are most impressive and strike the eye most forcefully are the negative ones. It wasn't long ago, along about 1911 or 12, that Dr. Jordan, the late Dr. Jordan, who was then president of Stanford University, organized the first academic course on international peace and arbitration. In that course, he built the thesis, very carefully documented in many ways. The time had come when man was too intelligent to use the destructive agency of war, which was doing him untold damage in many ways, but particularly in his biologic evolution, and he thought the time had come when war and violence had become obsolete. It was only a few years after that that the Great War that began in 1914 broke out. We have seen since manifestations of violence that perhaps have not been known in world history heretofore. We have all been shocked by the things which races and nations which had reached an unusual level of culture were capable of doing. Brutalities that are limited only by the imagination of man were employed, often with scientific skill, for effecting power, control. That was true throughout the development of the Nazi manifestations, the fascists, and so on. It's still true in a form that is even more systematic, more massive, more completely conscious of what it's doing in the Marxist development in the world. No one looking at these features might conclude the world is declining morally and spiritually, declining in dignity and beauty and virtue. That is a part truth. But the important fact underneath is that there is a pressure seeking to bring to birth a new and a higher power in the world, which in doing so threatens the sovereignty of these negative powers, which heretofore have largely lain latent in the consciousness of human beings, races, and nations, are now brought to the surface in an effort to resist this new development, so that they may retain their power and even their life, for that is threatened. We can measure the momentousness of the change by the intensity of the resistance to it. Now the principal leader, all along of this resistance has been the Marxist movement. It has been so not for the reasons that are generally given, namely those of a certain economic and political theory, or of a certain methodology, but for a reason that is much more profound. It is a fully conscious, systematic, dynamic, religiously intense form of materialism, meaning to root out of the world every iota of spiritual light that there may be anywhere, knowing what they're doing, consciously intending that, and very competent in their methods of implementing what they intend to do. It is for this reason that we can recognize in this movement the prime opposing force to the spiritual drive that is acting hidden and underneath. The Asuric force has in this movement revealed its hand. And there's no assurance, no certainty, that it may not achieve a temporary success. Not a permanent success. Nature can rise again, even though every spiritual light in the world were driven completely underground. Nature yet can find a way to rise again, and the spiritual light could come forth. But it might be thousands of years hence. Meanwhile, humanity passing through the shadow of a darkest of dark nights, beside which the dark ages of some 1500 years ago would be a small interlude of a relatively light twilight. That could happen. Aurobindo recognizes that possibility. That therefore the world is facing a battle that's real. A spiritual battle. It's more serious than any known within the limits of all history right now. Far more serious than the battle of the Mahabharata, though that was the occasion of the descent of Sri Krishna. The reason this is serious serious in a sense that the resistance to Christianity by the Roman world were only minor, is that the leaders in this movement know what they're doing. They deliberately take the premise that matter is primary and consciousness only an effect, essentially a helpless effect, in the nature of being. Now, for a person to be a theoretical materialist is not a serious business, necessarily, if he's content to let others hold opposed philosophies, if he advances it as merely one among possible theories, meets upon the open forum for the discussion of his point of view, he may contribute something of value. He is not a force of harm. The quarrel is not with that kind of materialistic theorizing. It is with a materialism that is dynamic, fanatical, and means to overthrow in the world all possibility of a spiritual movement, of a spiritual philosophy, of the activity of the enlightened souls that might be incarnated in this world. And they work with great powers. I'll mention one. Probably the best students of hypnotism today are the Russian police and the most advanced operators. There are forms of hypnotic control that no man can resist. They're violent forms. The techniques are basically simple. You wear a person down by systematic starvation, keep him from being able to rest, keep him in a condition of suspense, confine him in cells that have dimensions of 3x3, possibly about 5 feet high, keep him half-fed, so he actually doesn't have enough calories coming in to supply him, keep him in absolute isolation and silence where he doesn't even know that there's another prisoner around. Then you submit him occasionally to questioning, your questioner, apparently being sympathetic with his position, with his experience, pretending that it must be some mistake, offering some alleviation, but none coming, as a matter of fact. You get a man finally into a position where you can make him confess to anything. Those that have gone through this have testified to what happens to them. You lose the power to hold on to any conviction that you have. You're helpless, worn down. You just become little more than a lump of clay. And just to get relief from the sheer torture of the thing, you would confess that you are the man that blew up the moon. Anything. You would abandon your philosophy of life. You abandon your religion. The outer consciousness is so brought under such a severe control that the inner being would be thrust way back. Be helpless. Couldn't come through. You have systematic education of all of the young people, starting from childhood, that grounds them in the materialistic thesis and outlook and permit them to come under no influence that suggests a spiritual actuality. children separated from their parents and so on. The old parents who cannot be converted to a new order, either directly liquidated, used for labor purposes by methods that destroy them in about 3 years, or just put out to rot. The children are taken. That sort of thing aiming at world control, entering every country, seeking to get this grip upon every people whatsoever, including Tibet, the mountain fastnesses, could cut off humanity from consciousness of its spiritual roots until nature slowly emerged again after thousands of years. Now there's a reason why the present world situation is so grimly serious. In a certain sense, Morabito stands as the central focus of the force opposed to this negative Asuric power. I'm not going to be able to justify that statement to your satisfaction. Partly a matter of seeing into the whole situation. There are, however, external evidences that he does stand in a position of a leadership in this evolution. Still leading, though his body has been dropped. Still here, in the field of the human consciousness. Not less than he was while still living. And one can contact this consciousness, can know it as a power. Aurobindo is not primarily a retired philosopher. He's a dynamic, militant, heroic force. The crux of his work is actually spiritually martial. He's a fighter through and through. Certain sides of his nature are preeminently gentle. You can hardly believe this. One who's very gentle in his rebuking of Tsadakas, but in his collective force sense, a terrific spiritual power. In a certain sense, the two poles between the divine and the Asuric are preeminently represented by Sri Aurobindo and Joseph Stalin. The Asuric force being the force that is opposed to the spiritual principle coming in and taking over the world. Therefore, it is the enemy. Now, the battle that we face lies on several levels. One phase of it is just straight military. A deeper, subtler, more difficult phase is ideological and essentially religious. And there are inner phases that are hardly touched by the consciousness of most human beings. The concerning even actual battle, we face a principle enunciated by Sri Aurobindo that may be surprising to many spiritually oriented students and is quite different from the view taken by Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi enunciated a noble principle of power when he formulated the principle of satyagraha, which means acting in the world through the power or force of truth or soul alone, unsupported by any act of violence. You can find this principle as fundamental in the morality of Buddhism and in the morality recommended and lived by in the case of the Christ. It is a lofty moral principle, is the normal moral principle of a spiritually evolved human being. But if we take this principle and advocate it as a general rule of conduct for all men, regardless of their state of evolution, it becomes actually more destructive than it is constructive. And that's the shocking thing that Aurobindo has convincingly demonstrated. The problem is this. What hope have you of imposing the morality of a saint upon the conduct of a tiger? None whatsoever. The tiger has ages to evolve before the moral code of a saint to be his code of life. The most that a tiger can hope to achieve is the next step in its evolution. He might become a little more of a gentleman in his expression of violence, but he's going to be violent for a long time. Now, the morality of mass humanity, as it reflected in the nations, is a good deal closer to the morality of the tiger than it is to the morality of the saint. Nations at war, as Dr. Carl G. Jung pointed out, essentially move on the level of the tiger if they're reasonably decent, and if not, on the level of the alligator. Just watch. Just watch the moral code of the soldier in action, of the nation in war, and see that you don't find that that is so. Your attitude towards the other fellow is an attitude that's a dead ringer to that of the tiger and that of the alligator. Good to kill by foul means and all of that sort of thing. That sort of thing is taught in armies. What chance is there of teaching such a graha to a humanity that on average stands on that level? If by personal influence you can get an unevolved individual to try to live by it, as Gandhi did succeed in the case of some pathans being individuals about on the moral level of savages, you only get a repression of a violent nature. You do not get its transformation. And all repression sooner or later imply an upheaval in the nature into an explosion of greater violence. Hence, in the battle that's upon us, the spiritual warrior will have to move often with the instruments of violence, as did Arjuna. Many students of the Bhagavad Gita in the interpretation of that book have tried to make the instruction of Krishna purely symbolic, as representing an inner relationship in the life of the individual. Aurobindo points out that the Bhagavad Gita is not such a symbolic text, but a typal text. Quite convincingly, he points this out, and that what is there presented is a poetic representation of an historic event involving the actual descent of the avatar, talking to an actual warrior, presented with a battle, physical, on this plane, where he had to oppose an enemy consisting of not only friends, but of relatives, of companions and of teachers. And the requirement of his duty was that he should go forth and slay, as he could, these. You remember how his heart became faint. An emotional sympathy rose in him for these. It's better that I should die than that I should go forth and slay these. What good is victorious if these whom I have loved I have slain? And then Krishna begins his discourse and points out that his is the dharma of the warrior, that here is a crisis in world affairs, that there are forces that threaten to overthrow the order, the divine order in being, the dharma, and that it is the destiny, the spa-dharma of Arjuna and those lined up with him, to resist these forces and do everything he can to enthrone the forces that favor righteousness instead of these dark forces being victorious in the world. In the end, Arjuna is convinced. But in that discourse, we have the best formulation of the yoga of action. The true warrior goes forth with fighting without attachment, without seeking the fruits of his action, without hatred of his foe, but proceeds in the performance of his duty passionlessly, detached, selflessly. And in so doing, he makes for himself no karma. The same principle would apply in our present world situation. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a need, and a deep, deep need, for those who will carry the force of Satyagraha. As a matter of fact, the part played by the conscientious objector upon the fields of these battles is an even greater part than that of the natural warrior. Since if he's a true conscientious objector, he fights on a different level. He will take risks as others take them, and perhaps greater, but opposes one line of force by another that's on a higher plane. This is for those who in their evolution and the development of consciousness are evolved to this point. And the world grievously needs these. But it's not the path for all. Not everyone that calls himself conscientious objector is conscientious objector to violence. It's only a convenient device behind which cowardice hides itself. It calls for more courage than the path of the material warrior. But this is not the way of the mass of human beings. Here is another thing. He or the race or the nation that destroys one who is acting through soul force acquires a simply terrific karma. A race that destroyed one such being could well suffer through centuries. And as an act of compassion for these weak, unevolved material human beings who cannot yet rise up to the level of Satyagraha, therefore, the warrior should meet him with lesser weapons, the weapons that belong to his level. Well, there's a thesis that Aurobindo has developed in his essays on the Bhagavad Gita with a very compelling force. And you can see in the history of the world how the injudicious use of Satyagraha has brought forth aggravated violence sooner or later as reaction to it. It is a grievous problem. Now there is a deeper problem of ideology. The more serious level of the battle before us is on the plane of ideas, of philosophies, of ways of life. Here we are not doing so well. We of the West, naturally, perhaps because we are largely content with our way of life, have not felt the necessity of taking an active part in the ideological warfare. We're beginning to recognize it. This must be faced. But there is the deeper phase, and that is taking the spiritual step. Precisely in this day, which is perhaps the blackest morally in the world's history, when there is a threat aimed at all of our best values, just precisely in this day, it is easier to make the spiritual crossing. The superior power is closer in the crisis. And he who aims at realization will find there a helping force that is closer to him, more urgently active and crowding him than at any ordinary time. It is a period of opportunity. But he who makes progress in realization or toward realization performs the largest task, renders the greatest service in this battle which the Asuric forces are fighting for the control of the world. but few respond and few labor on this level. But it is the supreme level of the war that is before us. You might say that we seek most of all recruits in this battle for a world on this level. Yes, the basic conception is that before there can be an unfolding, a development, there must be an infolding. That's a basic conception of evolution as understood in all yogic philosophies that are evolutionary in form. It's quite different from the Darwinian conception, which is essentially materialistic. Yes, it's a maturing process. Maturing in this sense that which was hidden, bound, restricted in the veil of ignorance, gradually comes out until it is fully revealed in the end. And that I would certainly call a maturing process, at least from our point of view in values. There is a higher point of view where you can say there is no such thing as maturing or youth. But that's a consciousness that is immobile. Any other question? No, I don't know that it does. I have not heard so, but I'm not informed on what it does. I think the point is generally neglected, that there is not an appreciation by our leaders that the underlying battle is a battle between spirit and matter. Or rather, not so much between spirit and matter, as between a spiritual orientation and radical dynamic materialism. But that's the real issue, and everything else is secondary, subordinate to that. I know that there are philosophers who, in their criticism of Marxism, pass lightly over that phase, like Dr. Northrop, for instance, I conceive as by far the most critical phase in the whole issue. Oh, you mean kismet, our fate, that it doesn't work. Oh, I see, appeasement. Gandhi's attitude was not that of appeasement. It was rather that one should take a stand against unrighteousness, but without use of violence. It was the principle of violating an unrighteous law, for instance, and accepting the punishment in your own person, not trying to avoid that punishment, but arguing your case, presenting it, and being defenseless, non-resisting before those who would punish you, but still insisting on your position, going ahead. Method of self-suffering rather than opposing suffering on others. That's the meaning of Gandhi. Now, when you come down to the lesser matter of appeasement, of course, that's obviously a fallacy, that you can ever hope to satisfy the ambition of an asuric power by appeasing its lusts. If it is satisfied for the moment, it grows to a greater urge for power. And there's no end to that. No, it's not a rational force. It's not a reasonable or moral force. It is an endless lust for egoic power, egoistic power. Long for me to restate it, so I'll go into what I have to say without restatement. First of all, I brought in that example of technological development as an illustration of the force of change being active in the world, one of the signs that there was a force working. And as one of the causes of dislocation, but a minor cause. It was not intended as the major cause, but as one of the external signs of something happening. The efforts of peoples to throw off shackles is not the essence of the Assyric force. It's quite the reverse. The Assyric force takes the shibboleth of those that seek freedom as a means of building power, intending to establish greater shackles than ever before. I'm not condemning any of the efforts from below to move towards freedom, but I'm aiming it all at this one thing, an intelligent, conscious, diabolic power which seeks to make grab and distort the aspirations of simple people, among other things, to the end of founding a monstrous power. Its wings have been manifested to us in the Nazis, in the fascists, but most preeminently and most fundamentally, and fundamentally first of all, in the Marxists. The others are really reactions to Marxism. If you read Mein Kampf, you'll find where Hitler achieved his methodology out of his acquaintance with Marxism, and that was the first thing it aroused him, his reaction to it. The primary force was Marxism. Well, I don't know what institution you're referring to. And Stalin was a priest, of course, had repudiated the priestly attitude or the priestly idea. But if you mean to say that the violence of the Roman, exemplified in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, was a teacher, I'd say that that isn't enough. But the violence goes back much further than that. It goes back as far as history goes. If we want to find real violence in its most extreme form heretofore,
we'd have to go to something that looks very much like Stalin, namely Genghis Khan. That had nothing to do with Roman Catholic Church or anything Western. There you can learn. Violence in its purity. But you can't learn it even in any Western manifestation up
except the present time. No, the lesson of violence is about us on all sides throughout all history.
But the necessity exists to transcend violence is unquestionable. But if we now were to lie down, were to oppose our breasts in the spirit of the Satya Graha, before this Asuric force, they would trample over.
The power of Satya Graha supports
that there is a soul power in the one that you're dealing with, that it'll arouse the good that's in the other fellow.
But when you're dealing with thorough evil, conscious evil, a darkness that is absolute, there's nothing that you can appeal to there. I mean, that's what we're dealing with here. A darkness that's conscious and absolute. And would ride over the saints with no compunction whatsoever. Now, the riding over isn't a simple killing and making martyrs of them. It's driving them insane, modern techniques imply. Far more vicious than the old.
How is the saint to stand when his whole instrument of consciousness, his whole mind, his whole nervous organism has been racked to the point of insanity? This is the sort of thing that's done by this monster.
Don't let us people that permit their idealism to fool them are merely the victims of this power that knows how to grab people through their ideals. You know perfectly well what it does. It has no use for your ideals. You're merely a plaything.
It's naked power.
Dark. Black. Fully conscious, absolutely soulless. That is seeking to rule this world, to capture. As is true in no other point in history.
You're up against that.
It's world crisis, as world crisis has never been.